I'm Alan Jorsted, and this is a session on what I've entitled Creationism, A Second Look. And by that I mean, or another look, by that I mean that I think, as we'll go through, the decision which was reached in so far the most important case, the decision which is briefly outlined on the board here by Judge William Overton in the Arkansas case of 1982 was correct. But it's one of those things, in a way, we were talking about this morning, it raises other kinds of questions. One kind of problem is not necessarily solved, but at least met. And once that has taken place, then it raises other kinds of questions. And sometimes it raises questions which are going to be a little bit more difficult to solve than the one that's been raised here. But I would like to discuss briefly the importance of this case, the way in which the decision was made, and then raise the opportunity for all of us to discuss this. Because as some of you have heard me say, one thing I like about doing presentations at Holden is that there are so many people with so many good ideas, and with so many, there's an old friend back there, isn't it? The old French teacher from PLU, right, how are you? Nice to see you again. Okay, we're informal here, so, right, okay, good, it's been a while. Right, okay. Okay, good, okay. And anyway, raise the opportunity for all of us to make our own comments, because it should be a time really of sharing and not just a time of just listening to one person. I think that the whole question of creationism, and I'll define that in a little while, in the public schools raises really some of the most fundamental issues that we have in the whole field of, you know, religious concern in our country, because that's the thing that I've been trying to talk about in these lectures and presentations that I've been doing, because it gets at all kinds of questions that we consider fundamental in our own life. It gets at the question of freedom of speech. It gets at the question of freedom of religion. It gets at, you know, question of separation of church and state. And if those three weren't enough for biggies, you know, for issues, I've got a few more. But the whole question of creationism raises here. It raises the question, for instance, of the extent to which there should be parental control over public education, or the extent to which parents are surrendering control of education for their children really to the government. That's a very lively and a very difficult, complex kind of thing. It raises the whole specter, really, of hostility and fear and resentment towards, you know, the what we would call the intellectuals or the specialists in our society, and it raises tensions there that, you know, otherwise might simply have been overlooked. And certainly the whole question of creationism creates a certain amount of distrust towards our court system. We have the system of government where, in the final analysis, it's the courts who make the final decisions. And when you have growing suspicion and distrust of courts, obviously you have, you know, a very serious threat to the whole system of government that we have all together. And those would be some of the issues that I think are raised by creationism. And obviously we could spend, you know, an enormous amount of time there. But as we always say, time is limited. And so, you know, we'll go right ahead. And since time is limited, just for a change, I'll talk fast. And some of you know what I mean by that. All right. Now, the crux of the issue is not over whether or not the teaching of Genesis, the Genesis of account of creation in the public schools is constitutional. That's already been settled. There's no question over whether or not schools can allow the teaching of Genesis in the public schools. That's really been settled. It's never really been seriously questioned. But the real crux is over the demands of those we call the anti-evolutionists, the demands of the anti-evolutionists that creationism be taught as a science and given equal time with evolution. You see the difference between teaching of Genesis? Okay, fine. Genesis is one of the great books in Western literature, if you want to look at it that way, if you look at the Bible as, you know, as literature. Nobody's trying to stop Genesis as such being, you know, the material. But the question becomes whether or not creationism is, you know, a bona fide natural science, and then whether it should be given equal time with the teaching of evolution itself. Okay. This is, I think, basically the question. Now, a little bit of background, and then I want to go through this in a little detail. I should ask here for two things. Are there any attorneys here? When I get carried away and talk so fast, I get mixed up on legal terminology, and I'd like to have an attorney to keep me honest on some of the legal terms. What about any high school teacher who's had a question or problem with this on the local level? Anybody? Because they appear in strange, you know, sometimes they appear, this appears in strange places. I was just reading a fascinating account that's just broke out again in a suburb near Minneapolis called Minnetonka, where the whole thing has just broken out again and just wide open and going, you know, going strong. And in Northfield, it's fairly lively too. All right, now the case, there are lots of different cases in front of the courts because there are several different state legislatures who have passed pro-creationism laws. And not just necessarily in the Bible Belt, although the ones I want to be talking about are in the South, or the Southwest anyway, but there are states which have passed pro-creationism laws, and obviously then school districts, American Civil Liberty Unions, and various religious groups also have taken these laws, you know, to court, arguing that they are unconstitutional. Okay. Now, and the case I'm going to be reviewing here, the Arkansas Act of 590, is not the final case. There are still some which are pending, and I'm not saying that because Judge Overton has ruled on this one that that's settled the issue, you know, once and for all. But it is, I think, the most important, the most significant landmark case yet on the whole question of creationism, and raises these issues that I've talked about with separation of church and state, separation of our freedom of speech, and freedom of religion, or the free exercise of religion, which we'll get into. All right. The Arkansas legislature passed an act called, you know, 590, and that finally got to the federal court to the highest federal court in Arkansas itself. And it was a federal judge, not a state judge, a federal judge who ruled on it. So a state judge had upheld the law, or the act, and then they took it to the federal courts because the federal courts have jurisdiction here over this. And Judge William Overton, who himself was from Arkansas, he's not a carpetbagger, you know, that the Yankee liberals brought in. That has to be said. He ruled that the act was unconstitutional, that because the act, and I should back up and go a little bit into the act, and this might be a little bit detailed, but I want to be sure that, you know, the foundations are right on this. The act had required that, quote, evolution science and creation science should receive balanced treatment in the science classes, and roughly equal time between creation science, which we want to define now, and evolution science itself. And it specified that no reference to religious doctrines or religious materials were to be made. And it tried to define what creation science was, and it tried to define what evolution science was, and it said that wherever one was taught, then the other one should be taught also. Okay? Now, let me go through the case here that the creationists made, because I like to, you know, when we're dealing with something controversial, it'd be very fun and sometimes, you know, easy to be fairly sarcastic and, you know, put the other side down. But I want to go through the case which the others have made, and if it isn't clear, by all means, just raise your hand and we'll go through this. Now, the creation law, in other words, that I'm talking about, the Arkansas laws, went like this. The law made no mention of either God or the book of Genesis. Well, you say, well, that's, you know, what in the world is the trouble? If it doesn't mention either God or the book of Genesis, where can the trouble be? But in its definition of creation science, this particular act, the Act 590, listed these following ingredients here that I'll talk about. This particular listed these ingredients as what should be taught in the classroom. That's the thing. What should be taught in the classroom? All right, they set up an either-or dichotomy here for what should be taught in the classroom. They said sudden creation of the universe, energy and life from nothing. That's creation science. Or emergence by naturalistic processes of the universe from disordered matter and emergence of life from non-life. That's fairly stacking the vocabulary if you stop to think of that for a while. Emergence of by naturalistic processes of the universe from disordered matter and emergence of life from non-life. That was one definition of creationism versus evolutionism. Okay. A second one was changes, quote, within fixed limits of originally created kinds of plants and animals. That would be, you know, what creationism is talking about. Changes within fixed limits of originally created kinds of plants and animals. A third dichotomy defining evolutionism and creationism, separate ancestry for man and apes, as the creationists would have, as they would like to put it, and I'm going through their vocabulary here, separate ancestry for men and apes, or emergence of man from a common ancestor within apes. And finally, explanation of the Earth's geology by catastrophism, that is by, you know, something miraculous, by miracle, explanation of the Earth's geology by what they call catastrophism, or the evolutionary sequence by uniformitarianism. That is, that everything, nothing happened by catastrophe, but everything happened in a sort of a uniform, way. And finally, a relatively recent inception of the Earth and living kinds, or an inception several billion years of age, and somewhat later in life. Okay, so you see what they're trying to argue, that there are two different models for science, the evolutionary and the creationist. Okay, and I think that's fairly clear what they're talking about. So much of this is familiar, I just need to, you know, review some of the things itself. All right. Now, this was the law that was brought before, and it was creationism was being taught as natural science in some Arkansas public schools. Basically, what Judge Overton ruled was that creationism is not science. It is explicit, in his terms here, and I'm using his terms, it is explicit religious dogma. Hence, it could not be taught as science, and the Arkansas law which required it or established it was unconstitutional. Okay, that was the final decision. Now, I want to go through this in some detail because, as I've suggested, it is very important and it does raise all kinds of questions, and I think you'll see we have some time for discussion as we're going with this. All right. Now, what he did was to take a very, well, not only a, the traditional Supreme Court way of understanding, you know, religious laws and give it or apply to this particular law what has come to be known as the threefold test, the test which I have here, on the nature and the constitutionality of any particular act as it comes forward. And as cases as this and related cases about religious freedom and protection from sectarian and indoctrination of one position have cropped up, the courts have worked out a threefold test to see if any law, be it a state law, be it a national law, violates the free exercise of religion. Okay, that's what I'm trying to say. All right. Now, so what this becomes then, you see, this is why I'm not talking about the scientific part of it. What I'm talking about tonight is the constitutional part of the law itself. Okay, not the science thing. We could argue creationism, you know, for a very long period of time, and there is the, you know, the Creation Society and all of San Diego, isn't it, if I'm not mistaken? Right, yeah. And, you know, we could go into that, and there's endless, I've got a bibliography here that'll choke a horse on creationism versus evolutionism and so on. But I want to go at the constitutional part of it. All right. The issue then becomes, now, does creationism violate the part of the First Amendment which deals with religious freedom? Now, in the First Amendment, and if you look at the bottom here, the First Amendment says two things about freedom of religion in this country. There are two clauses to freedom of religion in this country, and they are really different things. First of all, the First Amendment says, you remember James Madison wrote it, that there should be no establishment of religion. That is, that the government should remain neutral and not in any direct way get involved in helping any particular religious denomination, advance its particular cause. Now, that came, I have to digress here briefly, that came out of a law in Virginia in the 1780s which tried to require that everybody pay taxes to the Anglican, or that later became the Episcopalian Church. And they said if you, the Anglican Church had always been there, therefore they should have it. Madison didn't like this, and Madison got exercised and got that law thrown out in Virginia, and then when it came time to writing the Constitution, Madison wrote most of the Constitution himself, the National Constitution of 1787, and he set up these two clauses to the freedom of religion one. First, no establishment of religion. We don't have, you know, an established church in America the way they have established churches in England or, you know, Sweden or Norway or wherever else like that. And that's sort of a negative part to freedom of religion. This is something that shouldn't be done, no establishment of religion. All right. Then the other side of it is the positive side of freedom of religion, that everybody should have the opportunity for free exercise thereof, of religion. If you have your religious convictions, you should have the freedom for the free exercise thereof, okay? Government shouldn't interfere. You should have freedom for free exercise, you know, to use their terminology, thereof. That's the if you want to put it, the negative and the positive part of this. Okay, is that clear? All right. All right. Now, and when this gets too complicated, just sound out, because I want to be sure this is clear. So what has happened is, over the years, there have developed or there have emerged obviously a significant number of laws and controversies, you know, within states and on the federal level also, which deal with this matter of religious freedom. Does this particular law violate the Establishment Clause? Does it violate the Free Exercise Clause? Classic case, and the one we're all thinking about since we're dealing with creationism, obviously is the Tennessee, what is sometimes called the Monkey Clause, or the Monkey Law of 1924-25, with the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee, and you know, and all that sort of thing. And what's fascinating to me is that at the beginning in our history, and I teach American history, at the beginning in our country's history, we had very few cases dealing with free exercise of religion. Most of the cases dealt with, you know, economic or taxation issues or all kinds of issues, but very few cases dealing with religious freedom. And it's only been really since about 1940, 1945, that we've had a rapid growth in the number of religious freedom issues. The first significant one, and we can talk about it a little bit later too, is whether or not the government had the right to force Jehovah's Witness people or children to have the Pledge of Allegiance. And to salute the flag, because they said that was wrong, and the government said, well, if you can allow one group not to, you know, to avoid saluting the flag, pretty soon you can allow everybody group, and you know, and there have to be some, you know, rituals or that were necessary. So we've had a very large number of cases appearing on religious freedom in the last few years, and of course, I suppose you could say the granddaddy of them all is, you know, Bible reading and involuntary prayers in public schools. That's the one that always is sort of hovering around the background, and we can talk about that a little bit later. And also, if we have time here, I wrote myself a note like Dan did this morning for E to remind him. I put down BJU as a reminder, because just last week the Supreme Court made a very important ruling throwing out the Bob Jones University law, which insisted on the right to have practice segregation and still have its tax-exempt status. So if we have time to get into that, you know, I'd be glad to do that, but I do want to talk about the creationism thing here. All right, now, over the years, and as these cases have emerged, the Supreme Court has worked out a threefold test. Every time a law comes up, it applies three tests to the law, okay? It applies three tests to the law and to see whether or not the law is constitutional. The first test is, does the law have a primary religious purpose? Does the law have a primary religious purpose? For instance, just to give you a couple of examples here, a law which requires Bible reading in the public schools clearly has a religious purpose. No question about that, because the Bible is one form of religion, the Judeo-Christian, as opposed to, say, let's say, the Book of Mormon, which is, you know, read in some Utah schools. All right. But state now, that would mean that law has a direct primary religious purpose. But another state law, which gives state aid to parochial schools for, say, busing or non-religious text, does not have primarily a religious purpose. And what has happened is that over the years, the courts have allowed school boards at their discretion to give money to local school districts to provide busing for children going to parochial schools, or let's say textbooks in languages which have a non-religious purpose. Because the argument is, if you didn't have the religious parochial school or the religious or parochial school in your district, you would have those kids in your school anyway. So you know, you can help. You're providing the original purpose of providing educational opportunities for all the children in your district. Okay, so that's the first one. Does the law have a primary religious purpose? The second test that the Supreme Court has worked out, does the law have as its main effect the advancement of religion? Yeah, the main effect to advance religion. Let me give you a couple examples on that. If you have a Sunday closing law really doesn't directly aid religion. There isn't really very much there that can be said to directly relate aid religion. So the courts aren't very excited one way or the other about Sunday closing laws. And if you pass them there, you can find other reasons for throwing them out, but not as a means of advancing religions.
Erwin, yeah. What do you mean by a Sunday closing law?
Some of you remember 20, 30 years ago, they got into a terrible mess in which only a very carefully defined number of business operations could stay open on Sunday. Yeah, and that got into all sorts of things. I remember there's a hill, I could go nostalgic here and not talk about the Minnesota closing law, and it really got just totally out of hand. And now finally, you know, they've just thrown it off completely and so on. Okay. So that's what I mean by that. But on the other hand, you know, talking about the main effect of advancement of religion, state-sponsored school prayer obviously directly, you know, advances religion. And those have been very controversial. Okay. Now, the third test, besides the two I have here, is the one of entanglement. All right. When justices look at a law, they'll say, are the mechanisms, that is, the way in which the way in which a law is carried out, are these mechanisms such that the government will become embroiled or mixed up with the religious groups and the religious issues? If you're going to have a religious law, does this involve, you know, what we call entanglement, or getting the secular government involved in making decisions over whether or not this law should be carried out? Let me give you one perfect example that I think all of us would understand right away. Say you've got a conscientious objector law. You remember in the last years of the Vietnam thing, a lot of people were applying for CO. All right. And that created the need to establish some sort of criteria by which you could judge the sincerity of whether or not somebody who applied for CO or conscientious objector status was really sincere. And therefore, the question becomes, should the state government itself be the agency to decide whether or not a young man, in this case, there were only young men who were being drafted at the time, so I can say young men here, should young men then, should their sincerity be evaluated by a state or a secular agency, because that's really a religious issue. How sincere you are, you see, about your religious issue. You see the matter of entanglement. Why should the state government have to make religious decisions about the sincerity of somebody who's applying for CO status? The best thing to do, you see, the test is, the best thing to do is keep the state government out of those entanglement things altogether. Just don't get involved with that. Or, for instance, let's take another one, because it ties in with what we're talking about here. I know in California, and I think in Texas, the one school board committee buys all the textbooks for the whole state. Yeah, I think that's right. And you know all the lively business that's going on with creationism in California. I don't know if that's true in Washington, but Oregon. But in Texas and in California, people in Austin or in Sacramento then make the decisions for the whole state. All right. Then that raises all kinds of business here about entanglements, because will the government, you see, be called to screen texts to be sure that they are secular enough, you see, to be subsidized by the state? Should the state board, which picks out the text, be involved in, you know, in saying, well, this is a secular enough text on evolution, so we can pass it out? In other words, you're asking public officials to make religious or moral kind of decisions. And that's what the government just says, we just don't, you know, let's stay away from entanglement. All right. So, to sum up then what I'm trying to say in this rather complicated thing then, if a law comes before the federal courts, and it violates any one of these three criteria, any one, not all three, but if it violates only one or two or all three of these, then that law, according to the Supreme Court, is unconstitutional. Okay? That's the threefold test which the court has worked out, the Supreme Court has worked out over the years. And that is applied then to all federal judges then, all in all 50 states are obliged then to obey the rulings of the Supreme Court. Now, you may not like that, but that's the law. Okay. That I want to be sure that's the step. All right. Now, what Judge Overton then did, you see, was to apply this three-part test to Arkansas Act 590. He decided that creation science, as I've said, creation science is no science at all. There's no scientific evidence that the world began in an unspecified cataclysm between 6,000 and 20,000 years ago, and that many species did not evolve from a single primitive life form, but they arose separately. A scientist, for instance, here would ask, what theory of origins best accords with the facts? Creation science asks, what theory of origins best accords with the book of Genesis? You see the difference between the two? Okay. Judge Overton said, as I said, creation science is no science, and I'll quote him. While anybody is free to approach a scientific inquiry in any fashion he chooses, he cannot properly describe the methodology used as scientific if he starts with a conclusion and refuses to change it, regardless of the evidence developed in the course of the investigation. That is, if you start by saying that the book of Genesis is literally, you know, scientifically true, and then that affects all the rest of your things, then that's your religious conviction, fine, but that's not natural science. Okay. Then, to get to the point here, he applied the threefold test, and he found Arkansas Act 590 wrong on all three of the tests. The purpose of the law. He argued there was no evidence that the sponsors were motivated by anything except their religious convictions. It was an effort to introduce the creation version into the public school curriculum. And that violated it, the fact that, put it the other way, it did have a primary religious purpose. Secondly, did the law have as its primary effect the advancement of religion? Judge Overton said yes. Both to its concepts and its wording, creation science is inspired by Genesis, and the act was consistent with the literal interpretation of Genesis. So the main effect of the law was to advance one particular interpretation of the book of Genesis. There are different ones, and they were saying it was wrong because it tried to advance one interpretation. And third, he said that state entanglement with the religion is inevitable under Arkansas Act number 590. The state would be involved in screening textbooks, forcing state officials to make religious judgments. The state, for instance, would have to monitor classroom discussion to be sure that the act was carried out. I mean, if you're going to have equal time for creationism and evolution, that means you would have to put some sort of state official in every biology classroom in the state to be sure it was carried out. And I don't think very many of us would want, some state official. There's enough hostility towards government anyway to have some official sitting there with a tape recorder, seeing how it would be carried out. I mean, there's no sense in having a law that you can't enforce. That's what he's really saying here. On this. And thus, when the Arkansas Act, 590 was brought before the Supreme Court, Judge Overton's federal court, it was thrown out on all three accounts. Okay? Now that's the factual part of it. And, I would agree, as most interpreters have said, that it solved one significant problem. It, to quote here, it prevented an intellectual fraud from being perpetrated in our science classrooms. Because the intellectual fraud would have been that creationism is of equal scientific value or merit, you see, with evolution itself. And it did protect the integrity of the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. All right, now that's clear. But then, as I said, the title is Creationism, Another Look, and I would like to suggest that there are some other issues, as I said at the beginning, which are raised here. It isn't just simply a matter of intellectual freedom. It isn't just a matter of, a constitutional issue. If it is just a constitutional issue, I think most of us would pass it by. But it does get right to the heart of some very significant American traditions and values, as I say, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and separation of church and state. Okay. One of the most important one is that those who support creationism, and usually these would be fundamentalists, but not necessarily always, these people believe, you see, that the teaching of evolution violates or undermines, that's a better word, they undermines the faith of their children. And if they have freedom of religion in this country, then aren't the public schools over which they, now have no control actually violating their freedom of religion? You see, that's a very real issue. They're forced to send their children to public schools. And in Arkansas, they were not necessarily, this isn't necessarily the case otherwise. And this is one reason, by the way, that Christian day schools, so-called Christian day schools, are growing. We're starting our third one in Northfield. We were a town of 12,000 people, and now this next year we're getting our third, we're getting our third school because there is disgruntlement with this sort of thing. Okay. So evolution does challenge fundamentalism. You see, because it's saying that one of the cherished interpretations and convictions of fundamentalists is wrong, or is something over which local parents, remember, parents don't have any control over local education. So it's a real challenge really here to religious freedom. All right. Now that raises the question, has the Supreme Court, and have our courts, but let's talk about the Supreme Court, has the Supreme Court really been hostile towards religious freedom in this country? Because there are those who argue, especially those I think, I don't want to go into anything personal here, but there are those who argue that the Supreme Court is a hotbed of, liberalism, radicalism. The new buzzword is secular humanism. I've got a whole speech on secular humanism I could give sometime here, and so on, but I think it would be like trying to convert, try to sell refrigerators to Eskimos. I think all of you would be, would be in favor of my speech. So if you want me to, I can give it later. But anyway, the argument is the Supreme Court has been a hotbed of secular humanism. All right. But if you look at the record, I think there are three or four cases where the Supreme Court has been very tolerant on religious freedom. Let me give you, just two or three examples. And there was a very famous case in 1963 in South Carolina, in which, to sum up the case without going into the details here, a person who was a Seventh-day Adventist had been forced to take a job which required her to work on Saturday. And she sued the Supreme Court on the basis of religious freedom, and they said, yes, that employer has to guarantee her the right to go to church or to have the Sabbath expressed in her own way, and she can't be dismissed because she's not going to work for you on Saturday even though you want her to work on Saturday. That's a ringing affirmation, really, of people for the free exercise thereof. Another one is, I've mentioned before, and the Supreme Court has now, after it reversed itself, but the Supreme Court has protected the rights of the children of Jehovah's Witnesses from having to pledge allegiance or say that we, or to salute the flag. That was a very lively case. Oh, that was Zorach versus West Virginia, if that rings a bell for many of you, probably not, in 1943, and it went around and around. But now Jehovah's Witness children do not have to pledge allegiance or salute the flag. And one of the most important ones, and it shows, I think, where the Supreme Court is going, in 1972, it's called Yoder versus Wisconsin, an Amish case, a very famous case in which the parents, there were Amish parents of two children, 14 and 15-year-old, took their children out of school, even though there was a requirement, you know, that you had to stay in school until you were 16, because the schools were seen as environments hostile to Amish belief. That was a real breakthrough, that the Amish schools were protected from doing this, as long as the teacher of these Amish children, you see, was certified. That then you get into the whole question of certification.
We could get into that Nebraska case, too. That was the whole thing. Remember that it padlocked the fundamentalist church in Nebraska because the children were being taught by a teacher who didn't have Nebraska certification. That, you know, there's all kinds of things. And once you allow no certification here, pretty soon, you know, there won't be any standards at all. And, you can be teaching astrology instead of astronomy. And aren't you sort of short-changing the children? You see the issues here. All right. So, you see the issues. The fundamentalists are claiming the right not to have their children, you see, standardized by the state. And they think that their case in creationism is just as good as Yoder versus Wisconsin. And that's why I think this case is going to go to the Supreme Court. Because they're arguing that if the Supreme Court did make a stand in favor of, you know, a broad interpretation of free exercise in Yoder versus Wisconsin, that they will have a very good case for this, and they're taking it to the Supreme Court. All right, now, the question then becomes, can fundamentalists be accommodated? Can we find some way by which the legitimate demands on the part, or the expectations on the part of the people, the parents, can be met, and still the legitimate educational, you know, requirements on the part of the state be worked up? I don't think, as I've suggested here, that the solution to the problem would be by making creationism into a true science, because creationism is pure and simple a religious doctrine. But I think that there are some other kinds of alternatives, and I have time to go into this, and we'll have some time for discussion on this. There is the opportunity of what we call elective exemption. Does that, I suppose none of you have been on school boards that have battled this through, all right. But you might want to think, we can have sort of a role model playing here. Think of what you would do if you were on the school board in your district and this came up. I think that would be fun. That might not be fun, but it would certainly, keep you awake at night. You might get some very interesting telephone calls, and I would wager in a few weeks you would have an unlisted number. On both sides, I'm not saying that the fundamentalists are wrong. Some of the worst of most obnoxious people are, it's like Carl Sagan, and you mentioned him, the idea that, his kind of science can do no wrong at all, and sort of a mystical, brooding, kind of crazy business. I don't want to get Carl started on Carl Sagan. I think he flipped. I want my own personal feeling. He lost his marbles and started to roll, I think, is what happened with him, but that's another story. Now, can you find some kind of accommodation? One is called elective exemption, all right? Children can have their children exempted from classes in which evolution is being taught. I think, and that has been upheld, wasn't it, in Texas, where sex education was being taught in junior or senior high, and parents didn't want their children, some parents said, we have that, so they petitioned for elective exemption, and the school boards upheld it on the basis of, I think that did happen. All right. So you say, all right, elective exemption sounds pretty good. Yeah, I just see my notes here. Well, when I'm down the room, look at your notes. All right. There it is. We have a wonderful old saying that's in our family that from my children's eighth grade arithmetic teacher, when in doubt, read the instructions. Old Kermit Wolf always said that. When in doubt, read the instructions. And I just, when in doubt, read my notes. Okay. Now, exemption, you see, would not foist the religious doctrine on students, who or not fundamentalist. But there are problems with elective exemption. It's not all, you know, it isn't all that easy. There are real problems with elective exemption. For instance, Darwinism informs many areas of knowledge. Darwinism isn't just in, you know, in the biology realm of knowledge. Darwinism informs history, it informs economics, you know, the idea of survival of the fittest and that sort of thing. And the point is that Darwinism will be talked about in other classes. Say a child doesn't get exposed to Darwinism in biology, he or she is going to get some kind of exposure to Darwinism in, let's say, a history class, because you can't talk about 19th century, you know, European history without talking about Darwin and all the things that, you know, that went along with that. So that's one problem with elective exemption. A second problem is, you know, the one, the parental, the discipline one. What if the children want to go, the children want to go to a Darwinism class, and the parents say no? How, you know, then you get the school board, or the, not the school board, but the principal, let's say, involved in a parental decision, you know, parental authority decision. And do you really want principal or their subsidiaries making, you know, decisions for that should really be worked out between children and parents themselves with it? All right. And a third one, and I think is the most important exemption really with our problem to elective exemption, is the goal that all education has, one of the major goals in all of education is to impart scientific knowledge to children. We want languages taught to children, we want, you know, mathematical skills, we want history, and we want our children, you know, to understand as clearly as possible what science, you know, natural science is all about. And obviously a great loss will occur if children were not exposed to one of the major branches, really, of scientific knowledge itself. All right. Now, that sounds fine, but here is where my other side comes in. We also have in America, and this is where I'd like to get to the discussion going, we also have in America, you know, the right to be different. We cherish this. We're afraid of, you know, conformity. We have the right to dissent. We have the right to stand apart, or we want to have the right to stand apart from the power of the government, you see, to coerce, you know, what we believe or what our consciences are. And where do we draw the line? It's really possible, and this is where I see the real complication with creation, the whole creation of issue. It's really possible that the public schools could become agencies, you see, for governmental indoctrination. That can be one line, and the government, the schools can become agencies for indoctrination. What made me think of this, and I know this is probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but when we were in Northern Thailand for the semester, we saw how the public schools and there were no options, you know, there were no alternative schools, because all of Thailand is Buddhist. The public schools became the agencies for training the children in one way of thinking, politically, religiously, socially, economically, everything else. Buddhism was taught in the schools, loyalty to the government was taught in the schools, the children had uniforms that they wore to school all the time, you know, you had Boy Scouts, you had the whole thing there, and the schools were that, and obviously, I'm not, you know, criticizing their form of government, because theirs is a whole different tradition than ours altogether, but the schools were clearly agencies for indoctrination. We saw, for instance, everything was rote learning. When the teacher would ask questions, and the children all would, by rote, would answer. And, you know, there was no discussion. All that went through this, that was their way of doing things, and, you know, that's their privilege. And so there is always a danger, you see, that public schools become agencies for state indoctrination. Yet at the same time, we say that we also believe, obviously, in our government in public education. We support billions of dollars for it. Our property taxes, you well know, goes largely towards paying for, you know, local education. So the question then becomes really to me, how do we reconcile the America of the melting pot, the America of the assimilator, who take all who come to our shores? On the one hand, and we like to think that we come out pretty much the same out of the melting pot, with how do we reconcile that with the America which prides itself on being the defender of the heretics, of the dissenters, of a disordered land where people have the right to be free, where people have the right to be strange, where people have the right to be wrong? And that's the question I'd like to, you know, to leave with us for discussion. So it isn't just, you know, you see, it isn't just whether or not evolution is right or wrong. You know, if anybody has an answer, I think that's a good point for discussion. Not everybody, I know I'm a little bit time to sort of soak in, but I think that raises a real issue beyond, you know, beyond the ordinary one. I mean, if, yeah. Just upon how many did go to relief time when they were growing up in school? Not very many. Was it done, Laura, by the time? Because it was in Northfield for a while. If it's an impact on you, you can't remember it, so. Okay, but anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt it. I was just wondering if, you know, yeah. But relief time was thrown off by the Supreme Court. And actually what happened, and it varied in the Northfield Ministerial Association, was in a way glad because it had become, you know, just very ineffective. The kids treated it as a big joke. And they would have contests to see how many donuts they could eat, you know, in 1 hour during relief time. And that sounds like typical junior high humor. And it was very, another problem, very difficult to find teachers. Who could you get on Wednesday to come at 10 a.m. in the morning, you know, to teach some of these things? The Sunday school teachers are fine. But when it worked, there was a local option, there were local alternatives. And that was the idea of trying to do it. But it broke down over administration more than anything else. Yeah. I remember it. They tried very hard, but they just gave up.
So when you use the term indoctrination, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there are any clear criteria to separate indoctrination from education.
Right, yeah. What do you think? What happens, you see, when, you know, in a way, it's like we've been talking about, or, you know, from yesterday, when there is an overlapping in the definitions of what is religious and what is scientific. And I can't remember which of the options on the board here we're talking about, but, you know, you had about 7 or 8 or 10 different ways in which the science-religion question has been, you know, has been dealt with. And I can't remember which one this was put in with. Because to some people, there is no conflict. The old thing, you know, evolution could have been God's way of doing things. That was one of the explanations that was put forward. Henry Ward Beecher called the problem of evolution for many American Protestants, I think that was God's way of doing things. So, and evolution itself doesn't deal with final first cause. No, it doesn't deal with final first cause. It doesn't deal with big bang, little bang, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, another question. What is the origin of compulsory education?
Yeah.
Contrasted with free public education?
Yeah. So, we didn't, you know, when we became separated from England in 1776, British didn't think it was until 1783, but when they surrendered, but we didn't instantly have free public, you know, compulsory education. It really wasn't until about the 1870s or the 1880s that got started, and free compulsory public education was aimed primarily at creating a solid core of citizens. It wasn't aimed at, you know, obviously a vocational education, but the idea was that America was the melting pot, you know, given you're tired, you're hard, you're tired, you're poor, you're hungry, mad. I think I'm just going to keep right on talking. When you have, you know, people from all over the world coming, how can you have then a democracy? That was the idea. This is good Horace Mann, you know, theory. If you remember from any of you from your education classes, this is good John Deere. John Deere. So there's another one. John Dewey theory. Not John Deere. Okay. I talked a little bit too much today. I think this is my second time around. So anyway. The idea being that if you've got people coming from, you know, from capital Orthodox, if you've got Jews, you've got Protestants of all kinds, you've got everything else, you can't have people who can have a successful system of self-government if they come from all these different backgrounds. Therefore, what you have to do is teach them the essentials of good citizenship. And the only way you can do that is to require that everybody come to school, because once you start making an exemption here, then, you know, you open the floodgates to everything else, every other kind of little exemption. So they insisted on that. And then when, you know, Catholics, and the two accepted, well, three actually, it was Catholics and Jews and mostly conservative Lutherans, because Missouri has had a long tradition, obviously, of, you know, parochial schools in this country. When they insisted that they wanted their children to have, you know, what they call education plus, the 3 R's plus the religious indoctrination which they wanted, then they had to go to the state and convince the state, you know, through certification, that their teachers were just as qualified to teach the basic 3 R's. So, all right, then they said, you can have your parochial schools, and your yeshivas, the Catholic school, I mean the Jewish schools and the others, and the Missouri Lutheran schools, as long as you have teachers who have been certified by the state. That was the one control that they had over there. And that lasted for a long time. And then small little exceptions started coming in, and the first really significant one was the Amish in 1972. I don't know if you can remember way back when Life magazine, I'll tell you how far back I was, but when Life magazine had a picture, it was in Wisconsin, showing two sheriffs on horseback with, you know, Smokey the Bear hat, chasing two little Amish kids through a cornfield, trying to get them to come to school. I mean, these Amish kids were really threatened due to the security of the state, and they were real criminals who had to be rounded up. And that did, you know, a picture, you know, says 10,000 words or whatever it is. And that did more to help win public opinion over to supporting the Amish than anybody else. And so the Supreme Court has been letting out a little bit of slack, you know, and now we'll see how much more slack they let out. So that's a Hubert Humphrey type of answer to your question. I can explain that. I'm from Minnesota, and I grew up under Hubert, so I learned to give a 15-minute answer to a three-word question. He would just be wonderful on Meet the Press or those things, where somebody would like about 15 minutes after, Hubert would be given a very embarrassing question, and he didn't want to give a direct answer. So he would filibuster, and as only Hubert could do, would filibuster, and then Larry Spivak would say, but Senator, when you get to the point, he said, yes, I'm coming to that. And about 25 after, Hubert was still going, and finally Larry would say, well, time's up, folks, and Hubert would say, that's right, I did it, you know, I talked for 15 minutes and didn't answer the question. And so I just did a Hubert, that's what I mean by a Hubert Humphrey answer. But that's, you know, the idea being that for self-government, you have to have a solid core of loyalty to the government, to the ideals of the country itself. And that is best done, Horace Mann, John Dewey, that is best done and only done through the public schools. And if you're going to have a yeshiva or a Catholic school, you also have to teach American citizenship in those schools.
So indoctrination, then?
They don't see it as indoctrination. They see it as basic necessity for survival. But you see it as, you know, probably as indoctrination, and I guess I would too. Yeah,
one of them. Isn't one of the problems that in the early days of the union, that there was a real desire to be part of the union.
Right.
You know, to be like America was.
Right.
Now, it can be just the opposite.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm of a different persuasion, or if I speak a different language, you have to teach me my language. So you better teach me in English.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to buy bilingualism. Right. Yeah. And in fact, there are real steps in that direction occurred a few years ago in Florida, not only in the public schools, but now officially all government work, anything public, officially public in Florida, can be done legally in either Spanish or English. I mean, if you want to go down and, you know, in your marriage license, if you want it to be, can be in Spanish as well as in English. And that's, you know, that's a step in, you know, in that direction. And Florida is becoming, you know, very much Hispanic. And that way, I think that's what's happened. You know, I was trying to say this morning too, I think that's part of the whole general trend. I think we're becoming more and more fragmented, more and more diverse as a civilization. The single issue political things are running away with us. I really think that's true. And the public school, you know, hasn't stood up very well under that strain. And this is why we're getting all the, you know, the religious day schools. And then of course you get into the whole question, you know, that maybe, you know, as some fundamentalists and others would say, well, the rejection of creationism simply means that the public schools, as well as the courts, are agencies of godless secular humanism. And there's more evidence of the decline, you see, of the vitality of, you know, of the American experiment. So let's get back to 1776, you know, and follow and say, my answer would be, I'd be delighted personally to get back to 1776, because then we could have people like James Madison, whom we could go to, you know, and Falwell never quotes James Madison, but I'm going to say something about Falwell later on. So. But that's not a Hubert Humphrey answer. Okay, I saw in the back here. One more. I'll try to be brief. I bet I smothered it. I bet I, you know, help you forget it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you ever give back Hubert Humphrey's answer?
Not as much time's run out. That's why I like whole the groups. I mean, you get these are the best groups anywhere for audiences and for participation. Really. Now that I flatter you, probably won't say anything. Yeah.
Well, going to seeing how that compulsory education and what Warner said that now it's defended not to be whatever that ideal America is, but everybody individual. Has that pretty much just proved that the melting pot was always just a myth anyway, and never really...
There are those, and this is the new trend really in my field in American history, that the melting pot really never existed. And it was a nice ideal, and there was some need for it, there's no question. You had to get people to pay taxes, for instance, to the government if they wanted the protection of the American government. But the latest scholars in American immigration history are pretty well unanimous almost in the fact that the melting pot was a great ideal but never really, you know, materialized.
And it's certainly closer to where it is now.
Yeah. At that time it was close to right. But that raised all kinds of, you know, difficult questions too, because you some parents couldn't afford to send their children to parochial schools where they could stay loyal to the faith, you know, like the yeshiva school, so they sent them off to the public school, and there they learned ideas that the parents didn't want them to. I'm thinking of some of you read Kim Potok's novel, The Chosen, you know, all these, that's the classic struggle or plot in all of Potok's novels. What happens when the bright young Jewish boy goes off to the public school, he learns to reject the faith of his parents and becomes an agnostic in this strange new land that's supposed to guarantee religious freedom. It's a good plot. The only trouble is that that's the only spot Potok has in all of his novels. One more question, then it's time for...
this isn't a question.
Okay.
That
was your first mistake, huh?
And I think, just from watching my own family, we just did a good job of melting together.
Good, I'm glad. I'm thinking on the official national level. We still haven't had an honest-to-goodness Gluvacha named as President of the United States. No, friendly. And we still have a Carter.
But we got it just making the
joke. That's a step ahead, right? And we've got a Perpich as our governor of Minnesota, and that's a real step ahead, especially if you know who Rudy is. So I think with that, you know, we'll call him and quit, and I'll be glad to talk to people after Vespers about this. And somebody ring the bell for Vespers? Because it's in 10 minutes, and you always like 10 minutes, isn't it? Basically, you like 10 minutes. Is it section 5?
You got 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, there it comes straight from the top. So, any 3 or 4 more? Sure.
I just wanted to say, what a rich opportunity that the birds have been seeing. I grew up in Minnesota also, and my grandfather spoke 7 languages fluently from Norway, and he would not allow any of the children to speak anything but English and speak it perfectly.
I grew up in the same family. It was bad, or you and I were talking about this, it was considered bad or un-American to speak some other language. So when I grew up, I was not talking Norwegian, because,
when I went to school, it was all white Scandinavian people. One American, right? It is.
Yeah.
And how sad that is.
Yeah. Because they're missing out on a lot.
And to learn other languages at a young age, how very easy.
I think that's pretty well been solved. That's pretty well been met with. There's more emphasis on foreign languages. The only trouble with foreign language education in schools, that's the first quote luxury to be trimmed. When school boards, you know, we had this in North Carolina, we had French for a while, it was a really very successful program, and then all of a sudden they started running out and they had to choose between soccer and, you know, or whatever it was, and guess who won? Yeah, I think that's, but bilingual education is, its time has come. It really is, its time has come.
Well, there's nothing wrong if you're actually teaching everybody 2 languages, or 3 languages, or 4 languages. But what's happening in California anyway is that, quote, bilingual education has raw speech Spanish.
Yeah. And then, as you mentioned last night, when they're young like this is when they best learn, when they best learn languages. You were talking about Swahili, how the 3-year-olds are speaking Swahili better than, people of college background and all the rest. Okay, well, to be continued. This is fun. The bell just rang. Okay.